thinking. Beginning again in the 19th century, near the beginning of the century, ministers used to write economics. One of the more famous of them was a gentleman, an Englishman named Thomas Robert Malthus, M-A-L-T-H-U-S. And he developed a theory of population growth, which many people have regarded as mistaken ever since then. Very pessimistic. He said the population, the human population, would grow faster than the means available to support it. And his idea, he was quite a good economist if you actually read what he wrote, but his ideas have been so caricatured that he's usually held in great disrepute today, because that has not yet happened, that the population has grown so much that the means available to support it haven't been there. About the time Malthus was writing, there was another clergyman named Whately, Richard Whately, W-H-A-T-E-L-Y. And he belonged to the classical school, as Malthus did. And he defined economics as the science of exchanges. He said, see how the ideas are getting broader as to what economics is. Adam Smith said it's the science of wealth and welfare. Mandeville, I forgot to mention his definition. His definition was it's the science of avarice. I suppose that's where Thomas Carlyle got the idea of calling it the pig science, the science of avarice. Whately said it's the science of exchanges. Whately was a very clever fellow. He was a logician. And at the beginning of the 19th century, the criticism of the Bible was already beginning. Actually, it had begun earlier with Spinoza. But there were critics writing about the Bible, saying that there never was such a person as Christ. We have no historical evidence of his existence. He's just something that the apostles made up. And Whately wrote a very clever essay called Historic Doubts Relative to Napoleon Bonaparte. And he published it in 1821, contemporary with Napoleon Bonaparte. Bonaparte had just exited the scene. You know, he'd lost the Battle of Waterloo in 1815. And what he does in this essay, what Whately does, is he applies the same principles of writing history to Napoleon that the liberal critics of Scripture were applying to Christ. And the conclusion of the essay is, when he gets done after about 25 or 30 pages of argument, is that then we have no evidence that there was such a person as Napoleon Bonaparte. And this is a, you know, the major figure on the European scene, Napoleon Bonaparte. But he very cleverly takes the same kind of arguments that the critics were levying against the Bible and applies them to the documents and the reports about Napoleon and says, we don't have any reason to think there ever was such a person as Napoleon Bonaparte. Very clever argument. So if you ever run across any of his essays or whatever, be sure to read Whately as well as Malthus. But there's a growing problem in economic theory in the 19th century. Not only do you have a division between the classical economists, who are more or less in favor of free enterprise and free trade, but you also have now the development of socialism in the 19th century, which takes the exact opposite view, that everything should be state control. The major socialist thinker, of course, was Karl Marx in the 19th century, the co-founder, or founder, whatever you want to call him, of communism. He published the Communist Manifesto in 1848 with his financier, the capitalist Friedrich Engels. And there's a little essay back there you need to read called The Communist Idea. I think I brought it. Yeah. which consists of an excerpt from the Communist Manifesto. Make sure you read that. This is the development of this thought in the 19th century, socialism. This is the idea that the means of production, the factories in particular, the farms, whatever is used to produce things, ought to be controlled by the government. Now, you can own your own toothbrush or your own harmonica, Bob. But the factories and the farms, whatever is used to produce things, ought to be controlled and owned by the government. And this is obviously the school of thought that dominated the 20th century, socialism, beginning with Marx. Marx's disciples, led by Lenin, founded, and we'll talk more about communism later, but they overthrew the democratic government of Russia in 1917. Keep in mind that in 1917 there were two revolutions in Russia, the democratic revolution in the spring and the communist revolution in the fall. They overthrew the democratic government of Russia and began a killing campaign immediately. And the estimates on the deaths from communism in the 20th century range upwards of 80 million people as they try to impose their brand of economic thinking on the world. What you young people have lived through is not the beginning of communism, but the demise of communism here at the end of the 20th century. The socialist experiment failed. But nevertheless, this is the most influential economic way of thinking in the 19th and 20th century. What happens in the 19th century, we'll talk more about this idea later, is those who are writing about economics are discussing the idea of value, and this becomes the central problem in economic theory. What is value? Is it objective, as Aristotle said? And if it's objective, where does it come from? Well, Marx said the value comes from labor. That's where value comes from. All value comes from labor. The labor that I put into the good makes it valuable. The classical economists tended to say, no, it doesn't come from labor, it comes from usefulness. It's what they called utility. It's the usefulness of the object, not the labor that went into it. The more general term for this was the cost of production theory of value. And this seems to be common sense. This overhead projector is worth $250 because that's what it costs to produce. That seems to be common sense. Or this lectern here is worth $25 because that's what it costs to produce it. And very many people find themselves thinking automatically, as it were, along the cost of production theory rather than the utility theory of value. In each school of thought, there were some important men. We've mentioned Marx here. Let me write Marx up here again, Karl Marx. Lenin, his principal disciple. And then we have perhaps the most influential economist of the 20th century, John Maynard Keynes, K-E-Y-N-E-S, Keynes it's pronounced, John Maynard Keynes. Marx ruled the socialist world and Keynes ruled the West in their economic thinking. Now, on the utility side, you have people like Jeremy Bentham in England, Say, the Frenchman, S-A-Y, in France. And these people would all generally belong to the classical school. Then you have a Frenchman named Bastiat. Perhaps some of you have read a book or an essay by Bastiat, Frederick Bastiat. And they all belong to the classical school. They argued for free trade and free enterprise. And they opposed the socialists in the 19th century. Unfortunately, they were losing the argument until three men, all about the year 1870, hit upon a new theory of value and began a new school of thought. Let me make some room here. That really has not been very influential at all outside of publishing some books and perhaps getting one or two people elected to office. These men are the British economist at the J-E-V-O-N-F. It's pronounced Jevons. Looks like Jevons, but it's not. Again, he was a logician. And there was a Swiss economist named Valras, W-A-L-R-A-S, pronounced Valras, and an Austrian economist named Menger, M-E-N-G-E-R. And they all published books independently of each other, all about the same year, 1870. And Jevons and Valras attracted some disciples, but they modified their theories a great deal. Menger is the only man of the three that attracted disciples who carried on his line of thinking and developed it to any great extent. And his great pupil was another Austrian named Boehm Bewerk, B-O-H-M with an umlaut over the O, B-A-W-E-R-K. And this fellow was the first one to write a refutation of Karl Marx's theory of economics. He wrote a book called Karl Marx and the Close of His System. And from this school of thinking, beginning with Menger, they developed what came to be known as Austrian economics. Austrian. This is not, if you hear the phrase Austrian economics, it's not a study of the economy of Austria. It refers to this body of thinking that began with Menger and was continued through Bewerk and his most famous disciple, the American Mises. Mises was originally an Austrian, but he came to the United States to escape Hitler in 1940, and he wrote many of his books while in the U.S. And what their contribution to, one of their contributions to economic, the history of economic thinking, was they attacked Aristotle directly on his theory of value. They attacked him directly on the theory of value. Up until 1870, everyone accepted almost unquestioningly the idea that value is inherent or intrinsic or objective. And they said, no, it's not. Oops. No, it's not. It's subjective. It's not objective. It's not in the object. Value is in the mind of the individual. It's not in this piece of equipment. It's not in that blackboard. It's not in this marker. It's not in any automobile. It's in the mind of the individual. That's where value is. Value is subjective. And we'll talk about this contribution and its implications to the theory of economics later on. Now, if you were here on Sunday, you heard yesterday, you heard Dr. Borgwein read some scripture from the Gospel of Mark, and the poor widow. You recall the story. The poor widow puts two small coins into the treasury in the temple after the rich people had put in large amounts of money. And Christ calls the attention of his disciples to this poor widow. And he says something extraordinary. She's given more than anyone else. Now, how could he say that? Obviously, the issue is not the dollar amount of the money given. That's not it at all. He's talking about the subjective value of the gift to the woman and to the rich people. And that's why her subjective value is greater, and that's why Christ says she's given more than they gave. If you're going to argue that value is objective, Christ was wrong. Obviously, they gave 100 times or perhaps 1,000 times as much as she did in dollars and cents. But he says the opposite. He says she has given more than they. Now, if economists had been paying attention, or philosophers had been paying attention to Scripture rather than to Aristotle, they might have hit upon a correct understanding of value centuries before they did. It wasn't until about 1870 that you find people putting forth, for the first time, the idea that value is subjective. Now, this idea is not found only in that one passage of Scripture, obviously. In fact, it's found in a very basic doctrine of Scripture. What does God say to Israel in the Old Testament about his reasons for choosing Israel, the nation of Israel? What does he say? Anybody recall? Right. Not because you're the powerful nation, it's not because you're a numerous nation, it's not because you're such nice guys that I chose you. You have value because I chose you. I didn't choose you because you have value. And you have value because I chose you. You're valuable because I value you. That is, value is imputed to them. It's not intrinsic. It's not objective. It's not inherent. They're valuable because he values them. Now again, if philosophers had been paying attention to Scripture rather than to Aristotle, they might have seen this earlier than they did. This notion of value as subjective. This notion of value as imputed, rather than intrinsic or inherent or objective. But they didn't. And it was only a little over 100 years ago, 128 years ago, that the idea becomes prominent in economic thought. Well, what's the status of economics in the 20th century? Well, let me erase this, and we can write down some of the schools of economic thought that perhaps you've heard of. A few years ago, when Reagan was president, you heard a phrase all the time. What was it? Anybody recall? Reaganomics. And what was that short for? Hey, we've got some Democrats in the audience. That's good. Trickle down. That was the derogative term for it. Supply side. That's what I was looking for. Supply side economics. Just know what you hear and read on the radio and television, huh? Okay, supply side economics. That was a common, and it's still somewhat influential, but that was one school of thought. What's the older school? I mentioned his name earlier. Keynes. Keynesian economics. Keynes was the fellow that said deficits are good. Keynes published his book in 1936, his major book, The General Theory of Employment, Interest, and Money. And what he did was he gave governments the excuse they needed to pursue the policies they were already pursuing. That is, high taxes, deficit spending, and inflation. And very influential, very popular economist at the time. Very, very profound influence on the development of the West. This year, if the so-called balanced budget that the federal government has now is actually in balance, and one wonders whether they are fudging the figures. But if it is in balance, it will be the first time since 1969 that the federal government has balanced its budget. The last time it balanced it was when Nixon was president, nearly 30 years ago. And one of Nixon's famous quotations along about 1971, after the balance, the budget was balanced in 69, there was a recession. Nixon gets on TV and says, we won't balance the budget again. We're all Keynesians now. And that's a quote. We're all Keynesians now. We understand the importance of having deficits. And they've run deficits for three decades. So now you have an official debt of something approaching $6 trillion, an unofficial debt at the federal level approaching, I think it's about $17 or $18 trillion, all due to the influence of John Maynard Keynes, an English economist. But there's all sorts of other smaller schools of thought. There's the Chicago School. I mentioned that earlier, Milton Friedman, generally free enterprise. Friedman wrote a book called Capitalism and Freedom. And very influential again, the Chicago School. There's the Virginia School, developed at the University of Virginia. It's very much like the Chicago School, but they have their own little quirks. Can anybody think of any others? There's actually hundreds of them. You have still in the academia, you have the Marxists still running around. In fact, they're very influential at some colleges and universities. You have all sorts of varieties of interventionists still in power in academia. And then the one we've mentioned earlier, which is the Austrian School. Now, I should mention some more gentlemen under this heading. Mises is one. He had a student named Hayek, Friedrich Hayek, another very influential economic thinker. Hayek won the Nobel Prize in Economic Thought in 1974, I believe it was. Then you have lesser people. All of these people, by the way, are dead. Rothbard, he was a student of Mises. I have a fellow named Senholtz, who was my economics teacher in college. He's a German, not an Austrian. Very interesting fellow. He flew in Hitler's Air Force during World War II, Luftwaffe pilot. He was drafted when he was 17 and flew Messerschmitt, Me-109s for Hitler, and was shot down in North Africa. Was sent to the United States as a prisoner of war, spent most of the war in Texas and Arkansas. Liked the United States so much, even though he was a prisoner, that he came back here after the war and completed his schooling and stayed here and taught economics for 30 years. Very interesting fellow. Hayek, if you see books by these gentlemen, I'd recommend you read them. Not one of them, with the possible exception of Senholtz, is a Christian or made any profession to be a Christian. Very anti-Christian in some of their writings. I mean, they don't go out and do the sort of thing that Madeline Murray did before she disappeared with all that money. But they do quite clearly in their writings say that the Bible is not true. The idea of God doesn't make any sense. They're naturalists, they're evolutionists in their thinking. But nevertheless, it makes very instructive reading to see their development of economic thought. And this is the Chicago School and the Austrian School are the leading free market schools of thought today in the world. They're the leading schools of thought in the world as far as free market goes. Now, what about Christian economics? Where does it fit in here? There aren't any people of this stature that are pursuing what might be called Christian economics. about, 25 years ago, Gary North wrote a book called An Introduction to Christian Economics. And it's a collection of his essays that he wrote when he worked for or wrote for the Foundation for Economic Education. And it is heavily influenced by the Austrian school, the free market school. And if you read those essays, and they're worth reading, I think the book was published maybe 1975, something like that. If you read those essays, you will see the footnotes to Mises and Hayek and the references to these gentlemen, and some references to Milton Friedman, Rothbard, very much influenced by the Austrian school, because it is a free market school of economic thought. And there have been other textbooks produced. Tom Rose at Grove City College, he taught there for, I guess, 10 or 20 years and produced a couple of textbooks on economics from a more or less Christian point of view. And you might check his book sometime if you run across them in a book catalog. It's R-O-S-E, Tom Rose. The Catholic writer, the great conservative Catholic writer, what was his name? He wrote the book, The Conservative Mind, Russell Kirk. Russell Kirk wrote a textbook on economics in which he tried to approach it from a free market point of view. It's an odd thing for Russell Kirk to write about because he never wrote about economics except for this book. But I think it was the people that publish Abeka books asking to write a text on economics for them, and he did. I suppose they paid him well. But it's a very strange thing to have Russell Kirk writing on economics. Outside of that book, he showed no interest in the subject. And outside of that book, he garbled the subject. So it's an anomaly just sitting out there for some reason. As far as going through Scripture and developing in a systematic fashion a theory of economics, I don't see anyone doing it. And that's a tragedy. Now, I realize there has to be a division of labor, and there are certain things more important to do than others. But there's so much work to be done in Christian philosophy that it's a tragedy that someone isn't writing more in economic theory. People are writing in applied economics all the time. In fact, there used to be a newspaper called Christian Economics, published by Howard Kirshner back in the 50s and 60s and early 70s. And unfortunately, it was sort of applied free market, applied Austrian economics. It really wasn't developing economics from Scripture. Occasionally, the writers would bring in a quotation from Scripture to lend some plausibility to what they were saying. But it wasn't an attempt to go to Scripture as the only source and develop a theory of economics from Scripture. And if you go to a library, visit a library, I'm sure you'll be able to find copies of that newspaper. It was published for at least 15 years, maybe a quarter of a century, called Christian Economics, beginning in the 1950s. Unfortunately, it's more ethics than economics, let me put it that way. What we have today, obviously, I've just skimmed the surface here. You have the rational expectation school of thought. You have the institutionalists. It just goes on and on. You have a discipline that is so fragmented and so compartmentalized that when you say the word economics, you have to specify which school of thought you're talking about to make any sense. And this isn't the case just with economics either. If you say something about psychology, there's at least 100 different schools of thought in the field of psychology. And you have to specify what school of thought in psychology you're talking about. Things are very confused. And this is something that they usually don't tell undergraduate students or high school students when they teach courses on these subjects. The professors are usually very dogmatic, saying this is psychology or this is economics or whatever. And it's only later, when they get out of college or when they get into graduate school, that they find out there's a whole world out there and their professors weren't being entirely candid with them about the confusion in these different disciplines. The disagreements. The old joke about, what do you get, if you ask three economists their solutions for a certain problem, and you get four opinions. Harry Truman once says that what I need really is a one-armed economist. And one of his aides says, what on earth do you mean by that, Mr. Truman? He says, well, I'm tired of these economists who will come in here and say, well, this is the way you should go. On the other hand, this is the way you should go. I want a one-armed economist. So sometimes economists reproach theologians with just being a babble of confusion. Well, it's much worse in economics than it is in theology, even. So don't, if some economist or some secularist ridicules your faith because theologians disagree with each other, you can point out the disagreements in any field of thought, especially in something like economics. Now, are there any questions about any of these things? Any questions about this very brief history of thought? Yes, sir. Yes, very much so. And it's affected both the... I'm sorry? Okay. The question was, has Darwin had an influence on economic thought? And my answer was very much so, both on the free market thinkers and on the socialist thinkers. Darwin, with his theory of the survival of the fittest, became a major factor in the development of socialist thought to begin with. In fact, Marx wanted to dedicate one of his books to Darwin because he saw Darwin doing in biology what he was doing in history, in the field of history. That is, Darwin had uncovered the laws of development in biology, natural selection, survival of the fittest, that sort of thing. And Marx said, I've uncovered the laws of development in history. I see how history or why history unfolds the way it does. Darwin explained why species have developed the way they have. And Darwin wisely turned down Marx's request to dedicate the book to him. But nevertheless, Darwin's influence was very great in the development of socialist thought. It was even greater in the application of socialist thinking in the 20th century. Because if men are merely animals, then who cares if we kill 80 million of them? Who cares? If they're animals. If there's simply one variety of species that has developed over eons of time on planet Earth, if they are not the image of God, if they are not the creatures of God, if there is no God to whom we are going to give an account, then let's get rid of them. If they're in the way, we'll just wipe them out. And the fittest will survive. So Darwin was very influential in the application of socialist thinking in the 20th century. Now, a little bit later on, we'll talk about the two major varieties of socialism. But you see it not only in the communist nations, but also in the fascist nations. Fascism is socialism. Somehow we've gotten the idea that fascism is the opposite of socialism. But Hitler's party was the Nazi party. And Nazi is simply the first two syllables of the German word for his party. It was the Nationalsozialisten, the National Socialist Party. and we shortened it to the Nazis. We got tired of saying the whole five words that were the name of his party in German. So we just called them the Nazis. But it was National Socialists. And Hitler, again, was very much influenced by Darwin. And he took Darwin's thought along racial lines rather than along economic class lines, as Marx had. He said, no, the correct application of Darwin's thought is along racial lines. And we are of the master race, and we will survive, and we will wipe out the inferior races. And they did their best to do so. And it wasn't just Hitler. There's a movement among some people to say that, well, Hitler didn't do it to begin with. And there's another movement that says, well, the German people weren't to blame. But if you go back and read what was going on in Germany until Hitler came to power, you'll see how much the German people were to blame for the genocide that Hitler engaged in. But the reason he did it again, and the reason that he got away with it, was Darwin. Darwin said, we are not creatures. The species have evolved naturally. The fittest has survived. And Hitler simply put into practice some of those ideas. So there you have a thinker who didn't write at all in economics, Charles Darwin, having an impact on the field. Yes, sir? I don't know anything about the field, about Eastern Orthodoxy's influence on socialism. Eastern Orthodoxy combined the church and the state very thoroughly and very early. But what their influence on socialism is, I couldn't tell you. I think one of the reasons that communism took root in Russia was because Russia never had a Reformation. You'll see the places where communism was most influential were the places where Christianity was least influential. Russia, China, the Asian Pacific. And those are the places that you'll find communism to be the most influential, where Christianity never was very influential at all. So there might be some connection there, but as I say, I don't know any direct connection. Yes, sir?
There's a debate going on these days in the political arena about terrorism matters. And I was wondering whether or not you've seen a connection where somebody has an example of the case and the person he was, and the way he wrote, the way he goes through the world, the way he
Well, Keynes had very little character. It didn't keep him from making a fortune in the stock market. Some people say, well, if his economics was, if his theories were so bad, why did he end up a millionaire in the stock market? And I simply go back to my lecture on science and say, well, sometimes false theories work. But Keynes was a homosexual, and he was one of the many leading thinkers of the 20th century that were homosexuals. Somebody nicknamed him Sugar Keynes because of that proclivity on his part. He grew out of a group of homosexuals in England, homosexual intellectuals, the Bloomsbury Group. And they wrote in every discipline and had profound influence on thinking in the 20th century. I suppose character counts in a negative way in that case. His lack of character seemed to give him more influence. His lack of character seemed to help his popularity. And I don't think anybody who's lived through the past 5 years can doubt that that happens sometimes in history. Well, deficit spending is an annual gap between how much you spend and how much you take in taxes and revenues. And the debt is the accumulation of those deficits. the official debt. The official debt does not include what are sometimes called unfunded. Yes, sir. Well, deficit spending is an annual gap between how much you spend and how much you take in taxes and revenues. And the debt is the accumulation of those deficits, the official debt. The official debt does not include what are sometimes called unfunded liabilities of the government. That is, all the promises the government has made to federal retirees, to Social Security recipients, to all these people. If you add up all those promises, those IOUs, as well as the official debt, that's how you arrive at that $16 or $17 trillion figure. But the official debt is somewhere between $5 and $6 trillion the last time I checked. These are large numbers. I'm saying trillion, I'm not saying million or billion. We're talking trillion. Yes, sir.
How are the Oxford School differentiated from the
Chicago School? Oh, good question. How does the Austrian School differentiated from the Chicago School? This goes back to the basic difference in philosophies between rationalists and empiricists. The Chicago School is an empiricist school of thinking. The Austrian School is a rationalist school of thinking. That is, the Chicago School, they want to go out and they want to do empirical research. You gather your data, you go out and you, if you want to find out things about money, for example, to take their great work. Now, Milton Friedman and Anna Schwartz wrote a book on monetary policy in the U.S., and they did all this historical work on the growth of money supply and the movements in prices, and they came up with this thesis about inflation, that there's some correlation between as money grows and prices tend to rise, all as a result of their empirical investigation, their historical investigation. The Austrian school is much more sensible, and this is what makes it attractive to Christians. The Austrian school starts out with a few simple ideas and deduces things. It doesn't go out and do research and investigation. It deduces things from a few simple principles. And it's a rationalist school. It doesn't start with scripture. They just start with certain axioms that, for all we know, they've pulled out of thin air. But they start with those axioms, and they develop a whole body of thought based on those axioms. And they do not engage in historical research. In fact, Mises wrote a book called Theory and History, in which he said no number of facts can defeat economic theory. No number of facts. There are two different categories of thinking. If you want to defeat economic theory, you have to show why the theory is wrong. You can't bring up a fact, a statistic, a matter of history. Mises was an extraordinary fellow. In the same book, Theory and History, he talks about theology. And he's a non-Christian, an anti-Christian even. But he says at one point, and I'll give you the full quote later in the week, he says at one point, the theologians are right. He says, we can know nothing with any finality or certitude unless it's revealed to us. And he recognized the limits of economic theory. Very candid in the book. Here you have an unbeliever saying, if you want to know anything with finality and certainty, it has to be revealed by God. He says, economic science doesn't give us that. Very candid. Yes, sir. Well, to some extent, both the supply side and the rational expectation people trace their ancestry back to the neoclassical people. You also have some of the interventionists in England who take the neoclassical thought in a different direction. Yes, sir.
Well, it seems like, correct me where I go wrong. So we started off with Aristotle having four ideas.
Yes.
And for hundreds of years, we went along there to be happy with that. And then we took that, and we, one by one, decided those are all wet. So we threw those away, and now we come up with a whole bunch of people having a whole bunch of different ideas, some of which are also probably wrong, but they like them better. So what I'm trying to do is, I can't deal with all that. I need to go back and feel like it's 1 unified theory so that I can deal with that. So what question are we trying to answer? Are they trying to explain why we're doing what we're doing? Are they trying to predict where we're going to go? What are they doing to either one of them?
Well, again, the disagreement in economic theory at the present day is over what question are we trying to answer. There is no agreement even on what questions we ought to be talking about. And so you have economists writing books with titles, What Should Economists Do? And I'm not making this up, by the way. There are books out there with that title on, What Should Economists Do? What questions ought we be discussing? And that's part of the problem, that's part of the disagreement. I hope in the course of the week that I can give you an argument from Scripture saying what economics is and what ought it include and what should it exclude and that sort of thing because of this confusion out there. Yes, sir? Yes. Yes.
Now, does that make the mercantilists kind of
thought under socialism? The question is, if mercantilists advocated protectionism and the classical economists advocated free trade, does this make mercantilism a sort of socialism? And one could say that, but it would be anachronistic. Socialism as a full-blown theory didn't develop until the 19th century. But they did agree that the state should control trade. They may not agree with the socialists that the state should control domestic manufacturers, but they should control international trade. So in that sense, one can say it's a form of statism. Yes, sir?
Is there any one theory that we're arriving on in our country right now that is floating along on its own indefinitely?
I don't see any one theory as being in control at the present time. You have a variety of opinions at the Federal Reserve. Alan Greenspan, the chairman of the Federal Reserve, is an advocate of the gold standard. He wrote, he's a disciple of Ayn Rand, the advocate of laissez-faire capitalism. He wrote an essay 30 years ago saying why we should have a gold standard. And now he's head of the nation's central bank, the Federal Reserve. In Congress, you have the House Majority Leader, Dick Armey, also a free market economist, this time of the Chicago persuasion. Then you have in the White House I don't know what you would call it, neo-Keynesian school of thought. But the White House responds so much to the public opinion polls that if the polls show that the American people want a balanced budget, then the president's going to come out for a balanced budget no matter what Keynes says. So it's really, I don't see any guiding principle at all there. It's just a confusion, not only in academia, but in carrying out the ideas as well. Yes, sir? Perhaps you could. Any unbelieving thought has that motivation. It's a rejection of the revelation. It's a rejection of the truth that God has given to man. And they're going to go out and develop their own theories. What's curious about the Austrian school, and again, I don't know anyone who has done the historical research necessary on it, is why why Jevons and Valras and Menger, all of a sudden, in 1870 or thereabouts, jettisoned the idea of objective value and say this is the problem. This is the central problem in economics. We've been operating on the wrong theory for 2,000 years. Whether any of these gentlemen were influenced by a reading of Scripture, I don't know. And to my knowledge, no one has written on the subject. But that would be an interesting question to find out. Sometimes secular thinkers who may not even believe the gospel are influenced by what they read in the Bible. They'll pick and choose what they take out of the Bible. But nevertheless, the influence may be there. And there may be some connection. Again, I don't know. I don't know anyone who's written
on that subject. Yes, sir.
The matter of Kierkegaard and his subjectivism or subjectivity, I don't know how much he was read outside of Denmark, though. That would be the problem. He had very little influence while he was alive at the beginning of the 19th century. Nobody read Danish. There's a lesson in here for you budding authors. If you intend to be well-known, don't write in an odd language. Because nobody paid any attention to the great Dane of theology. It wasn't until the 20th century that Kierkegaard was influential at all, and that was through the neo-Orthodox theologians. Any other questions or comments? Yes, sir.
Can you say that we have a situation in our own history of a biblically informed, actually biblically informed economic and for example, I'm just familiar with Calvinism and
Well, some people have argued that the Puritans, the Puritan economic experiment in New England, they attempted to be biblically informed. That was their intention, certainly. But as a matter of fact, what they ended up with was, I think, less biblical and more Roman, or more classical in the sense of Aristotelian. One of the major difficulties, as I see it, with the Reformation is that the Reformation never produced a philosopher. You had great theologians. You had Luther, you had Calvin, you had Knox. But they did not produce a philosopher. So what you find happening a century after the Reformation is the Protestants establishing colleges and universities, and what did they use for textbooks? They used the medieval textbooks. Yeah. They used the medieval textbooks. You have the Roman philosophy and theology being introduced by the back door, as it were. And I think what happened with the Puritans in New England is they adopted medieval economics. So you have laws regulating prices. You have price fixing by the government in Massachusetts. Just prices. They believed in the theory of just prices and just wages. And they intended to be biblical, but whether they were biblical is another question. In my reading about it, it seems to be more medieval than biblical. Calvin's Geneva? I don't know.
Yes, sir.
Well, what about, to go back farther to what Beth was trying to say, the Jewish time.
Mm-hmm.
Would that be closer to where we want to go? Would that be a better picture of God's idea of the economic system?
Well, I think it would be. No, I don't think the particular circumstances would make any difference. Now, there are laws, obviously, that apply to Israel alone and can't apply to no one else. The view that all the Old Testament laws are still applicable today is absurd. It's a view repudiated by the Westminster Confession of Faith. So you're not under the laws that were unique to Israel, but there were general principles of the civil law that are still applicable today. But even in the Old Testament, I don't recall anything about price fixing or setting prices for goods that were traded. I don't recall anything of that sort. It was regarded as something that would be worked out freely among those who owned the property. what price things would sell for. And you don't find any role for government in fixing prices, for example. I thought of something earlier, and I need to mention this, because it's been in the news lately. I don't know how many of you have followed the news of the bad weather in, I think it's Brazil. And there's a famine occurring in Brazil. Or is it Argentina? Somewhere in Latin America. Is it Argentina? And the Catholic Church has taken the official position that stealing in that situation is neither a crime nor a sin. They were defending the looters in the famine. And if you're on the internet, you can go back about a month and read some of the news stories about it. Where did they get this idea that stealing is neither a crime nor a sin? Well, they got it straight out of Thomas Aquinas, who says that very thing. He says, if a man steals to feed himself, if he's hungry, and he steals, it is not a crime nor a sin to do so. And in making that official proclamation, they're simply keeping Thomas's teaching in that area alive. That is the official teaching of the church. And it's made it somewhat difficult, I guess, for the government at that point, because now they're faced with the proclamation of the church that this is neither a crime nor a sin. So what do you do with these looters? Puts the government in a rather embarrassing situation. When you weigh as much as I do, see, I can't steal. I'm obviously not hungry. But if you're slim like you are, you can go out and steal. You have a plausible case that you're hungry. So who knows where the cutoff is? It makes it very subjective. Very peculiar there. But there you have again a current instance of a medieval doctrine put forth by Thomas Aquinas 700 years ago being applied to a specific situation in Latin America in 1998. Now, I don't know what the situation is like in Indonesia. Indonesia, the economy is collapsing. And I don't know if the church in Indonesia, which again is a heavily Catholic country, has made a similar proclamation about looting. But they have done so in Argentina. Neither a crime nor a sin. Any other comments?